It's been a year and a half or so ago that I did a series of lessons on the miracles of Jesus, where we went through various individual miracles and talked about what the miracle was pointing to in terms of being a sign, what it showed us about Jesus and his character, his identity, his ministry, his mission, so that we drew attention away from the amazement of what it was that Jesus did and focused more specifically on what it was that Jesus was trying to show us in that miracle. One of the things that we didn't talk about in that series at all is the issue of Jesus performing miracles as it relates to a postmodern, secularized, skeptical world. And that is, if you go out and try to tell your neighbor, well, I believe in Jesus. Well, why? Because he performed miracles. Yeah, right. What makes you think this guy performed miracles? What is it that makes you think somebody could take a bunch of water and just magically turn it into wine somehow, or walk across a lake, or tell the storm to stop blowing and it stops, or take a little bit of food and feed a multitude, or whatever else it may have been? What is it that makes you think that Jesus was able to do those things? Well, I've had occasion over the last several weeks to study this issue of miracles in a little bit more depth. And so I thought I'd come back to this and share with you some of the things that I found. This is going to be a different sort of lesson on the miracles, obviously, from the others. This is more of an apologetics sort of topic. We talk about how it is or why it is that we can believe that the miracles happen. And it's probably going to take at least a couple of lessons to get through this. Hopefully I can keep it to two and not have to drag it out too terribly long. And so what we're going to talk about is today the skeptical objections to the miracles, and I think we can get through all of these. If we have one or two left over, we can bring that into the positive evidence that we'll talk about in the next lesson. Well, as we talk about miracles in this kind of context, you know, how can we know that Jesus performed miracles? I think it's really important to begin with defining our terms to make sure we're all talking about the same thing. And so when I talk about miracles, obviously, and I don't even need to say it, I don't imagine, but obviously, we're not talking about kind of the colloquial sense of, you know, I made it from here all the way to Dale Mabry without hitting a single red light. It was a miracle. Well, no, that's not what we're talking about when we talk about miracles, the way that people just kind of throw the word around in common usage. But more significantly than that, when I talk about miracles, I'm not talking about God's providential working through His creation. The things that God does and God is in control of. But you also could say that could have happened on its own without God doing it. Whether it would have or not is a different issue, but it theoretically could have. So, for example, this guy named Cyrus was born at a certain time and became the king of the nation of Persia and took over the world, destroyed the Babylonian Empire, and sent the Israelites home. Did God do that? Yes, he did. Absolutely, yes, he did. The Bible is clear about the fact that God did that. Could that have happened without God doing it? Well, you know, would it have is a different question. Could it have? Yeah, a guy could have been born. He could have risen up to this position of power. He could have done all of these things. So when God works through nature, he works through his creation, he acts through normal, natural means to accomplish his purposes, that's not what we're talking about when we talk about miracles, at least in this context. I would refer to that as God's providence, God's providential action, not God's miraculous action, just to make our terms clear. Well, what are we talking about when we talk about miracles? Well, here's the definition I've come across that I think is a helpful way of thinking about it. A miracle is an event in which God temporarily makes an exception to the natural order of things to show that he is acting. This is what we're talking about when we talk about miracles. Now, this is the sort of thing that different people object to for a variety of reasons, and I think it's helpful to talk about those kinds of objections that people make as we think about what it is when we're talking about miracles. Some say, well, the problem with this is that it suggests that God isn't doing stuff all the time. Well, first of all, I don't think that's what this definition is saying. And I do think when we define miracles, we need to be careful that we don't do that. We don't need to slip into what's called deism. Deism is the idea that there is a higher power out there somewhere, but he really doesn't have anything to do with us. He's you know, he's a god of some kind, but he's not a personal god. He doesn't care about us. He's not involved in this creation. And we need to make sure that we don't define miracles in such a way that suggests God is a deistic God. Paul tells us very clearly in Colossians, and the author of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 1 as well, that it is the power of God working through Jesus that is the upholder or the sustainer of this creation as well. God does not, you know, come in and act in a miraculous way in a world that he's normally absent from. That's not what's going on here. But again, this definition isn't saying that God does that. This is saying that God does act in a special way, but not that he's absent. Another objection to this issue of the language of an exception to the natural order of things is sometimes you hear someone will say, well, God uses the natural order of things to accomplish his purposes. And so the problem with this definition is that God normally uses. So like, you know, when God parted the Red Sea to let the Israelites go free, he used wind. So God's using nature to accomplish his purposes. And yes, God does sometimes use nature to accomplish miraculous things. But again, what we're talking about here is not God using nature, God not using nature. We're talking about an exception to the natural order of things. When was the last time that a wind blew so hard in Egypt that it parted the water for long enough that that many people could walk through? It's happened once in human history. Which means it was an exception to the natural order of things. I mean, if it happened, you know, every third week, and it just so happened for that to occur right as the Israelites needed, then yeah, that's God's providential action. But this is the only time that has ever happened in human history. Yeah, this is miraculous. It is an exception to the status quo in that kind of example. Let me give you one other reason that some people object to this kind of definition, and it's an exception that sounds really good when you hear it, or a problem that sounds really good when you hear it, and I think there's a lot to be said for this perspective, just that it doesn't work as a reason why you've got to throw this definition out. Some of you may have heard of Tim Keller before. He's written a lot of books, very good thinker about biblical things, even if we would disagree with a lot of specific things that he says. But what he says about this, he says, we modern people think of miracles as the suspension of the natural order, which is a similar sort of idea here. But Jesus meant them to be the restoration of the natural order. The Bible tells us that God did not originally make the world to have disease, hunger, and death in it. Jesus has come to redeem the world where it is wrong and heal the world where it is broken. And there's a lot to be said for that. I think that's a really good way of thinking about what Jesus is doing. You know, Adam, way back in the garden, sinned and broke creation, you might say. And Jesus has come as the second Adam to redeem creation. And that's certainly biblical. But does that mean that miracles can't be thought of as an exception to the natural order, or a suspension of the natural order, because Jesus set about to redeem things to how they were supposed to be? Well, there are two problems I have with that as a broad definition of miracles. First of all, that might work really well for Jesus' miracles. What about everything before Jesus that was miraculous? Was Elijah also redeeming the natural order as the, you know, Old Testament figurehead of the forerunner of the Messiah who was set to... how far back does this go? More significantly than that, I don't know that Jesus' redemption of the natural order is something that you see in all of his miracles. Yes, God did not intend death, and resurrections point us in the redemption of the natural order. How about walking on water? How about multiplying food? I mean, if man had never sinned and they lived in the garden and you got to the point, I mean, God tells them to be fruitful and multiply before they're kicked out of the garden, so you presume they would have families there. You know, a couple thousand years in, Adam and Eve and all of their descendants in this big world, they're hungry one day. And Adam sees an orange tree across the river, and so he just strolls right across the top of it. But there's only a couple, so he grabs those two and feeds all 10,000 of them. Is that what we're supposed to think it was normally going to be like every day? And it's hard to say what it would have been like, but I don't get the impression that all of the miracles are that kind of redemption of the natural order of what God had always intended from the very beginning. That they are pointing to things Jesus is doing, but not every single one is to set nature back to the way that it was supposed to be. There's more than that just going on. And so I think Keller's point is fantastic, and I think it's something we need to think about, and it's something that I would like to come back to think about as we kind of transition from this sort of focus to the Lord's Supper itself. But it doesn't really solve the issue of defining miracles and this need to talk about it in terms of things being an exception to the natural order or to natural laws, you might say. Which brings us to the last thing that we want to define, and I didn't put this on the screen, perhaps I should have. That when we talk about natural laws, we're talking about things that are descriptive rather than prescriptive. Now, what that means, if you're not familiar with that kind of terminology, is that it describes the way things are. It doesn't prescribe the way things have to be. You know, you're never going to walk through a clearing in the forest one day and stumble across a stone tablet on which is engraved the law of gravity that someone had written. And the law is here, and the reason gravity works is because this law says so. And, well, no, that's not how the laws work. The laws of nature are humans' descriptions of what they see happening over and over and over and over again, to the point that we're certain that's the way that it always is, without some sort of reason, you know, without something that kind of breaks in and interferes in one way or another. So when we talk about natural laws, and we'll come back and talk about them again a little bit later on, we're talking about things that are descriptive, not prescriptive, and I think that's an important step as well as we think about this. So what sorts of skeptical objections are there? Well, first of all, there's a host of historical objections to miracles, and we'll work through a few of these, and we'll see if we've got time after these to get into some of the others, or if we need to save those for another time. But when we talk about historical objections, we're talking about things that, for a variety of reasons, people say you can't trust the record of the miracles for one reason or another. One reason why people talk about probability. They talk about probability in a variety of ways, but basically what it amounts to is that when you think about how things really are, and you're looking back at a record of something that happened, you know, 2,000 years ago or more, think about it in probabilistic terms. The probability of something regular happening is significantly higher than the probability of something extremely rare happening. And so when you just think in terms of probability, the odds of a miracle happening are just astronomical that anything like that would ever happen. And then also, you say, well, wait a second, there's witness testimony to this. Well, again, think in terms of probability. What's more likely, that someone has come back from the dead or that somebody is wrong about what they said they saw? Well, I know a whole bunch of people that have been wrong about things they said they saw. I've never seen anyone come back from the dead. So, you know, statistically speaking, the odds are so incredibly low of these miracles happening, you might as well say that, you know, they couldn't have ever happened. Now, not everybody would come out and say it exactly like that, but that's basically what it boils down to. And one of the ways that this idea of low probability will manifest itself is people who say things like, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence. Now, that you might have heard before. That is all rooted in this probability sort of argument. It was probably made most famous by Carl Sagan, a skeptical scientist, but it's repeated all the time. It's amazing to me as I read chapters in various books by Christian apologists, people who are believing, and not just people who are believing, but people who are in the middle of a chapter making a defense for miracles, saying extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence. They say that all the time. But is that really true? Well, you know, what do you mean when you say that? What do you mean by extraordinary evidence? Well, the problem with the skeptic is they never define that. You know, probably what the Christian means, and several of the authors would go on to say things like, you know, you need really good evidence, or you need a lot of evidence, or you need to carefully examine the evidence. The skeptics never define what it means. They just, they throw out that platitude, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence, and they leave it at that as if that answers the question. Well, how much evidence would it take? Tell me what this extraordinary evidence is, and we'll see if we have it or not. Well, they're not interested in whether you have the extraordinary evidence or not. They're interested in throwing out a cliche that they think is going to shut down the argument. The best case of this at all is a Scottish skeptic of the late 19th century named David Hume. You may have heard of his name before. He's one of the most famous skeptics writing against miracles that there's ever been. Well, he's in the middle of writing this and saying things like this. You know, you can't trust them because of this and that and the other. And he goes on to talk about a case that was a little bit before his time. But it has every sort of kind of evidence that he says you have to have. You know, you need a whole bunch of witnesses. You need people that are right there. You need people that aren't, you know, just, you know, the term that he would use is barbarous. People that are intelligent. And he, you know, goes through all of these different things. This is the kind of, and we don't have any of that in any miracles. Well, there's this one case where we have all of it. And what is his conclusion? Well, we know that that didn't work because miracles are impossible. That's his conclusion. He goes through everything. He shows a case that has everything. And then his conclusion is, well, miracles can't happen anyway, so this must be wrong too. And that tells you everything you need to know about the skeptical position when they talk about extraordinary claims demanding extraordinary evidence. On top of that, we all believe in extraordinary claims all the time. Anytime you turn on the news or open up a newspaper and it reports what the lottery numbers are, have you ever said, no way, that can't be it? You know what the odds of those numbers being picked were? It's astronomical. It's like one in millions and millions. I need more than just report that that's what those numbers are. I need like five independent cameras all focused on the thing from different angles, run by different people with no bias whatsoever. And then, you know, after I see all of that, then I'll believe that those were the numbers that were selected. No, you believe that those were the numbers that were selected. Because there's good reason to believe it in that context. And that's the problem. We believe extraordinary claims without extraordinary evidence all of the time. Because we understand that rare events happen. That's what happens in life. Extremely improbable things happen all the time. And so the argument from probability is a ridiculous argument. It can't really be something that rules out miracles. And one of the things about probability as well that the skeptics don't talk about is that the probability begins to balance itself out as well. Because one of the key issues of quality evidence is quantity evidence. As the number of eyewitnesses goes up, the probability of them all being wrong begins to go down. And then on top of that, the fact that you've got multiple independent witnesses testifying to something that is the same, you know, the odds of them all being wrong goes down, then you also have to explain where it was that all of them independently got this wrong information, which makes the odds go even further down. A couple probability mathematicians ran some numbers, and they said the convergence of six reliable independent witnesses being mistaken about the same thing is about one in a trillion. Now, for what that's worth, David Hume, who I was talking about a moment ago, one time he gave a number that he said the odds of the resurrection happening were. This one in a trillion number is five times larger than Hume's odds against the resurrection happening. And so again, when you're talking probability, once you start to think about it, it all balances itself out. And can you think about the practical absurdity of probability arguments? You know, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I've just had for the last 3 months 500 independent witnesses come through and tell you they've never seen my client murder anybody against the one person who said that they saw they did. What are the odds? You know, your job as reasonable, sensible people is to listen to the greater odds here. Well, no. What those 500 people say is irrelevant in the face of what the one or two or the circumstantial evidence or whatever else the case may be. And so the probability argument really doesn't make any sense. And also the probability argument suddenly becomes absurd if there is a personal God. And if there is not a personal God, then what are the odds of the laws of nature being broken? Really, really low. But if there is not just a God, but a personal God who is involved with his creation, what are the odds that a miracle would happen? Well, you know, it's hard to put a number on it, but I would say they're much higher that miracles would happen in that kind of context. A similar kind of argument to this one that's a little bit different still that you might hear from time to time is an argument from analogy to the present. Basically, that there must be uniformity between the present and the past. That we know what can happen in the past based on what happens now. And what we know is that miracles don't happen now, therefore we know miracles didn't happen in the past either. That's kind of how this argument goes. Well, there are a variety of problems with this argument as well. First of all, it presumes that miracles don't happen now. Now, I don't personally believe in the continuation of miraculous gifts. My guess is most of you don't either. I've not polled everybody in the room, but my guess is most of us are kind of from that camp of people that don't believe in the ongoing miraculous, as we have defined miraculous today. But the reality is there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who do believe that. And whether they're right or wrong is not the issue. It's just that in terms of analogy to the present, you've got loads of people that would say the analogy to the present is that miracles do happen, not that they don't. And you've got to deal with that when you're trying to make this kind of argument. Are all of them just crazy and wrong? Or what do you do with that? A bigger problem than even that, from our perspective, is it kind of presumes that miracles were an everyday occurrence in the Bible. And they weren't. And we've talked about this before. When you talk about the miraculous in the biblical text, what you find are a bunch of miracles around the time of the Exodus, and a bunch of miracles around the time of Elijah and Elisha, and a bunch of miracles around the time of Jesus, and not much else beyond that. I mean, there's an occasional one. You get three guys thrown into a fiery furnace, and they're walking around like it's no problem at all. And so you got a couple things going on in Daniel. But for the most part, the miracles are limited to those time periods. And what that means then is you've got times where there are hundreds or thousands of years that go by with no miracles at all. I mean, if there are no miracles between, you know, the creation, the flood, if you want to consider that the miraculous as well, and then Exodus, you've got thousands of years between miracles. And so think about that in our modern terminology. Miracles happened 2,000 years ago and they haven't happened since. Is that analogous to the past? Well, yes, it is. If that's the way miracles worked in the Bible. Long gaps in between them? Sure. It still fits with this. And so that really doesn't work either. And then on top of that, the argument from analogy doesn't allow for singularities. And there are singularities. There are individual things that happen. And they only happen once. Like that skeptic that you're arguing with about miracles. He was only born one time. So based on the argument from probabilities and analogy, he was never born. Well, no, that's ridiculous because you're talking to him. Creation never happened, or the beginning of the universe never happened. The Big Bang, if that's what they want to say. There are singularities over the course of the history of the universe. And if you say everything must be exactly like it has always been, it doesn't allow for these things that we know are the case. And singularities are something that we know is the case. We see them happen from time to time. Well, some say, well, the problem here is that history can't examine the miraculous. The source of the miracle is a, you know, non-empirical supernatural being. Historians can't detect a non-material supernatural being, so history can't study it. Therefore, we can't call them historical, is what it amounts to. You know, they're matters of faith. We can't talk about them as something that actually happened. Well, you know, you might say, okay, well, that's fine. You can't talk about God in that kind of historical sense since you can't examine Him. But what about the effects of God? What about the effects of the miracle? What about that tomb that had a body in it, and then it didn't have a body in it anymore? Could you examine that? Well, yes, you can. What about the people that were really hungry, and then suddenly they weren't hungry anymore because they got fed this really nice meal? Could you examine them? Well, from our context, we can't, but historians could have when that miracle happened. So whether or not miracles themselves can be examined historically, obviously, the events around the miracle can be examined historically, and this is not one that skeptical historians, an argument they want to make anyway. Stop and you think about it. What this means is you can't prove miracles wrong either. Say one day, archaeologists found a tomb, and they identified it, you know, undeniably as the tomb of Jesus, and the bones inside as undeniably Jesus' bones. We have disproved Christianity. Sorry, can't prove anything regarding miracles. You haven't proved a thing. Well, no, they want to be able to disprove miracles, but you can't have it both ways. You either can examine them historically or you can't examine them historically, and you can't try to disprove them in that sort of way. And by the way, they're never going to find the bones of Jesus anyway. But that's, you know, obviously another issue here. And then one final one, historically speaking, is the argument from subjectivity. This is certainly one that's very prevalent in a postmodern culture like ours. Everything is subjective, so history can't be trusted. So whatever they said about miracles, you know, whatever evidence you might have from historical records of miracles having happened, well, you can't trust those things because all that's subjective anyway. Well, the problem with everything being subjective, you know, there is no such thing as objective history, is that philosophically it's a self-defeating argument. There's no such thing as objectivity. Well, is that an objective fact or is that your personal opinion? Because if it's your personal opinion, then you haven't proven that there's no such thing as objectivity. And if it's an objective fact, then you've disproven subjectivity by giving me an objective fact. And so, you know, philosophically it's a self-defeating position. It just doesn't work at all. And then we know that there can be history, because objective history, because we know there can be bad history. Let's say you've got two historians. One says Hitler killed all of the Jews that he killed because he hated Jews. And one says Hitler killed all of these Jews because he deeply loved the Jews and wanted them to get to heaven faster. One of those is true and one of those is false, right? One of those is good history and one of those is bad history. And we all acknowledge that. And you can figure out which one is which. I mean, he wrote a whole bunch of stuff. Go read what he said himself. And it'll tell you which one of those is true. But if there can be good history and bad history, that means you can judge history. And the only way you can judge history is if there is an objective history to judge it by. There's no such thing as bad history if everything is subjective. And then we're constantly rewriting history as well. You know, historians, you know, continue to have jobs, not just because history is ever evolving, and not just because we need people to teach it to us, but because they're continuing to go back and revisit the historical records and to rewrite it. And part of the goal of that is to make it better. To bring it closer, you find something new and it shapes your understanding of something that you had a partial understanding of before, and so you rewrite it with that new information to make it more accurate, to make it better history. And again, all that is to say that there is objective history. You can know this kind of thing. And so these kinds of historical arguments really all fall by the wayside pretty quickly. We'll look at one more briefly because it doesn't take nearly that long, and that is naturalistic objections to miracles. And this is basically that, you know, miracles are violation of the immutable laws of nature, and immutable laws can't be violated, therefore miracles never happened. Now that's a little bit of an oversimplistic way of saying it, but that's basically what it boils down to. Miracles, and this has to do with defining the terms again. When you say miracles are violations of the laws of nature that can't be violated, well, yeah, it's an amazing thing. When you define something in such a way that it's impossible, it kind of turns out to be impossible. And that's kind of what's going on here. It presumes the laws of nature are prescriptive rather than descriptive. It presumes that nature is all that there is, and nothing can ever impact what's going on in nature. But what if there is something that is outside of nature? What if there is something that is supernatural? If nature is seen as a box, a closed box, and the lid is closed and nothing can get inside, then yeah, everything that could ever happen is within that box. But if someone can reach down and open the lid and reach inside and maneuver the contents of the box, well, that changes everything when you think about that. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about God not breaking laws of nature, but suspending them temporarily for a purpose. And the question of God's existence then is at the heart of everything when you talk about miracles. And at least the logical possibility of miracles should be pretty clear if there is a God. Even to the most devout skeptic, they should be able to understand philosophically that a miracle could happen if there was a supernatural being who could exercise his influence over the natural order of things. And not just any supernatural being, but a personal supernatural being. One who created and is involved with his creation, has a relationship with his creation. It moves things from not just understandable and not just possible, but probable in that kind of context. And the reality is, we understand the idea of the suspension of natural laws. We experience it all the time. There's a philosopher and apologist down in South Florida named Paul Copen that I heard speaking at a conference one time, and he said that he was speaking. I think he said he was speaking at the University of Miami, but I might be wrong about that. And he said, "This is how I proved to them that miracles could happen." I said, "How many of you believe in miracles?" And two people raised their hands. And he said, "Well, let me disprove you all. Here's a miracle." And he stood there, and he does like this. He lifts his arm. And everyone looked at him like he was out of his mind because they had no idea what he was talking about when he does that. But what he's illustrating is that natural laws are suspended, they're changed all the time by means of a higher power acting on them. He had overthrown inertia. The laws of science had been broken and defied because according to inertia, his arm should have just hung there like that forever. Well, no, we understand that when a higher power acts on something, it changes the order of things within nature. There's an author from the late 19th century who described where a pebble happened to be sitting on a shore and how impossible it was that pebble could be anywhere else and all the things that would have required larger waves and higher wind and different temperature, different relation to the sun and planetary orbits. He goes through all these things of what it would take to move that. And then he says, but along comes a little boy chasing his butterfly or whistling his tune, and he picks up the pebble and hurls it at a squirrel. And again, that's the basic idea. And those examples are perhaps a bit silly, but they make a point. A personal God who acts on nature makes the naturalistic argument against miracles nonsensical. If there is a God who can act, then there can be acts of God. That's what it boils down to. And to say that there can't, again, it presumes the answer instead of arguing for the perspective. And so those are some of the kinds of objections that you'll hear from time to time. We'll come back at a later time. We'll talk about some philosophical objections then also some religious objections before making a more positive case for miracles. But as we think about Jesus and his miracles that he performed, the things he did, again, I would have you think back to what Keller said, because although I don't think it's a great definition for every miraculous event, it does tell us what Jesus was up to, at least in part of his mission and in the miraculous element of it. Jesus has come to redeem the world where it was wrong and heal the world where it was broken. And this is what we're remembering as we think of Jesus. He has come and he has brought his kingdom, and his kingdom has broken into this natural order. And he's begun the process of redeeming the creation for what God has wanted it to be. And you see glimpses of that in some of his miracles, and it's a foreshadowing of what is going to be the case in everything when we join with God in heaven. And we take this memorial to remember what he did until he comes again and completes the task that he began.